Thanks for joining us on Battle Walks as we walk across the great battlefields of Europe. If you're enjoying the show, why not become a member? Every week, you'll receive exclusive bonus episodes available only to subscribers, and you can listen to all our episodes completely ad-free. Click on the link in the show notes to join us via Acast Plus.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm historian Matt McLaughlin, and thank you for joining us this Anzac Day to talk about two very special battlefields, iconic battlefields for Australians and New Zealanders. We're going to talk about Gallipoli, and we're going to talk about the Western Front in France and Belgium, the two places that during the First World War really defined the Anzac legend. And more importantly than just learning about the history is understanding what the battlefields can offer today, because there are many reasons you would walk the battlefields to try and connect with the original Anzacs. But the thing that is consistent across all these battlefields is the landscape. In many cases, the landscape hasn't changed dramatically from the First World War, particularly at a place like Gallipoli. But even in places like the Western Front, where it's reverted to farmland, the battlefields still give up their secrets. There still is so much to find in the landscape. And walking the ground tells you more about the battlefield than you could ever find from just reading a book or watching a video like this one. It's just such a wonderful experience to walk the ground and learn about the men who fought and died on that ground, whose footsteps you are following in. So thank you very much for joining me. It's going to be a wonderful journey together as we learn more about the landscape and the ground on the battlefields. And we're going to start with the Western Front. It's a wonderful place to visit. It's probably my favorite battlefield, the first battlefield I visited. And I always have a very special place in my heart for the Western Front. And we're going to be joined now by someone who knows the Western Front very, very well. We've seen him before on these videos. You may have heard him on my Battle Walks podcast. He lives in the heart of the battlefields and he knows them better than just about anyone else. Coming to us from France, it's Pete Smith. Pete, it's always a great pleasure to have you joining us from the Somme. And as always, mate, I'm very jealous that you're over there and you can literally walk out the front door and be in the battlefields. I mean, we've discussed this in podcasts and videos before, but your home is right in the middle of the battlefields, isn't it?
It is indeed. And later on today, I will be walking out onto the battlefields because I'm on tour. So, all very exciting.
I mean, the important question, I think, Pete, that lots of people would ask is, why do we walk the battlefields? Why can't we just read a book or read those riveting personal accounts that we often come across, or watch amazing movies like 1917 or All Quiet on the Western Front? Why do we actually have to get out there and get our boots dirty and walk the ground?
Well, I think to answer that, I can really just talk about myself. At the age of 10, I became interested in the war and into my early teens. And it wasn't until my late teens that I actually had my first visit to the battlefields. And I have to say, I didn't feel that up to that point it was necessary. As a young child, I had my toy soldiers and my fort. And then I had my various things I'd collected, some memorabilia and photographs and books. And for a long time, I thought, well, that's enough. You don't really need to be on the battlefield. But it is absolutely the most important thing to get a feel of the landscape, to understand the landscape. And my experience tells me that everybody that I've ever taken onto the battlefield, who it's their first visit, they're experiencing it for the first time, is they stand there and they go, golly, or other words to that effect, it's not what I expected. It's very different to what I expected, and I should have come years before, because it starts to put things in perspective. And I know the very first time, I always quote this because it's the very first time I went to Anzac Cove and looked up at the bluffs above Anzac Cove and the ridges, and I thought, I'm going to have to get all the books out again and start again, because it felt so different to actually be standing and walking on the landscape.
We've been talking about the area in Belgium, the area of Flanders, which is a very special area. I know both you and I absolutely love going up there and exploring the ground. This is the area of the famous Ypres Salient, or Ypres as it's known to the local people in Flemish, where so much bloodshed occurred in such a tiny area. Just talk to me about what it means to walk the ground there and what you seek out when you walk those battlefields that helps bring that history to life.
Well, first of all, you need an understanding of where the positions are so you can make sure you're in the right place. Distance, it's the distance, it's the height. And of course, on the salient around Ypres, you've got these series of ridges. And that's one of the most important things, is to get that understanding of what the Germans could see, because they are going to be on those ridges for most of the war, in fact. And so that understanding of actually walking into the lower ground where our lands, where the British and Empire forces were based, and the French and everybody else basically was facing the Germans, the Belgians, to get that understanding of looking up and look and feeling how overlooked you are. That's very much an important part of that understanding of the landscape, but also to get an idea of the terrain, literally the terrain. You know, we have a general feeling that the Great War was fought on a very flat landscape, and certainly with the salient, this flattish area around the Ypres itself, the town, we get a feel that is also this very flat landscape. But it's not. It's also a rolling landscape, and one that needs to be explored. The real flat landscape that we associate with the war is, in fact, French Flanders around Fromelles and the area around there. That is where it is totally flat. But around Ypres, it's not flat. Even the salient, overlooked by the ridges around, it's not flat. There are ripples and little small ridges. And so, yeah, it needs to be experienced. It's very important to walk that landscape.
And Pete, we've walked it together many times, and it's always a fascinating experience. And we've been to places like the iconic Hill 60, which is still shows the devastation of 4 years of war. We've been to Tynecott Cemetery, where you can walk around those huge German bunkers that still remain and run your hand across the concrete. And we've been deep into Polygon Wood, where you find more German shelters and New Zealand shelters. What are some of those tangibles that you always love going back to and visiting up in the Ypres Salient?
Well, you've pointed out the three things, really. You want to have a look at a piece of preserved landscape, and there is so little, certainly in our sectors, the sectors that the Britain and the Empire looked after, fought over. There's a lot more preserved areas in France, but in the salient, not that many actual preserved areas. So Hill 60 becomes a magnet for people to go and have a look at a landscape that retains an element of what it was like at the time. Obviously, there's plants and grass and trees and things growing there, but it is still a landscape that needs to be explored, and thankfully we can still do that. And I think for a lot of people that perhaps even have a relative connection, a connection through their family history, through their genes, that they want to literally to walk on a landscape that their relatives may have walked on, then that is important to go to somewhere like Hill 60 where you can do that. And then the enormous German blockhouses, of course, an awful lot have gone. They've been destroyed by after the war, a deliberate effort to remove them. But there's still they were difficult to remove, obviously. So there's a lot around. So to actually go and touch one of those and to get a feel of the weight of concrete, again, it's important. You get an understanding, even though nowadays the landscape around these, the bunkers have changed, but to walk and touch one of these bunkers, very important that they are preserved, and they are in Flanders, they are all preserved. Sadly, not so in France. They're not preserved, but in around Belgium and Ypres, then they are preserved. They will hopefully remain now. And it's great to go and touch them and to have a look at them.
I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, Pete. If you had a spare afternoon, if you were up in Ypres, you'd enjoyed a lovely lunch and, you know, steak and chips, and you'd had a cold beer and you had an afternoon to yourself, where would you go? Where would Pete Smith, who's walked the battlefields for thousands of hours, where would you go up in the salient?
I like walking the bluff. The bluff is again on the ridges, and I like the bluff, and I do like Hill 60. We've talked about Hill 60 because I like walking on the original landscape. But I also like the cemeteries and the stories within within the cemeteries. Now you have put me on the spot as to which cemetery I would go to. Well, I do like Polygon Wood. I have to say Polygon Wood, New Butts British Cemetery, because there's so much to tell there. I mean, for those people that have ever been on tour with me, they'll know that I get stuck there. I can be there for a couple of hours when I should only be there for an hour. There's just so much to talk about there. So. Yeah, I'm going to say Butts New British Cemetery, one of my favourite places to visit.
And of course, the Australian 5th Division Memorial on the Butt overlooking the cemetery. It's a very special place. You've probably nailed the spot I would go to as well. We were talking about this interview, Pete, and there's nothing that demonstrates the tangible connection you can make with history by finding relics on the battlefield. And you, as someone who's walked a lot of the battlefields, have graciously agreed to show us some of the things that you found and just some of the amazing stories they can tell. So what have you got there in this little segment of show and tell that you can show to us?
It was a difficult decision to decide what to show you. And you know, people like wary things and to handle something that was there. I actually quite like personal things. But I thought, let's show some of the larger lumps as we're actually going to be physically looking at this. So I'll bring up the first thing here. And what we have here is a rather mangled and crushed German mess tin. This was actually found on the Somme in this case. But why I found it immediately moving is this damage you can see here. This is caused by a plough. This is a plough that's crushed it. This damage on this side, and they go right the way through to the other side, fairly obviously. These are actually shrapnel holes. At first, I thought they were bullet holes, but I looked carefully, and the size is too big. These are lead shrapnel balls that are punched through this German mess tin, and I just found that amazingly moving, mainly because there's another reason. These black stains you can see on this are from the fires where this sat. In a fire to heat it up, whether it had stew or something in it, and it's left a residue on it, and that's a direct connection with that man that carried this, and you have to say almost certainly died with this on his back, because these were carried on their backs, and to get this damage on it, then he would be lucky to survive. There is a hope that he dropped it, but I think it's unlikely. So that's the first thing, and that's something I like, a piece of personal kit with rather horrific battle damage on it from a shrapnel ball. The other reason is, I suppose, I find it interesting is because the artillery and the is the great killer of the Great War, and that those shrapnel balls airburst, bursting in the air, so it's an interesting piece to show people and to bring home the fact that artillery was the big killer of the Great War. So that's the first thing, and I'm going to go to
say. Just on that subject, Pete, that's a fascinating find. And you're right, those personal stories that you can tell from items or that you can speculate about are always the most moving. And it still happens all the time. You and I were on the battlefields on my signature tour 6 months ago, and outside a cemetery, I just leaned down, and in the side of the road bank was a small piece of a British water bottle. You could tell from the blue enamel of this water bottle, with two very neat bullet holes straight through it in that small little piece. So again, what was the story of the man that was carrying that on his hip or in his pack at the time? And hopefully he had dropped it already, but you know, it's unlikely, as you say. The men didn't throw these things away. They were important items and they carried them with them. So what story did that tell, the two neat little bullet holes in the water bottle?
Yeah. And then I'm going to go to something which is unusual that it's actually survived, and is this. So what is this? Well, I have to say why it's unusual that it's still here is because it's solid brass, and this, the field walkers, they were called metal walkers in the 1920s, who walked these the fields all over the battlefield areas. They were licensed and they picked things like this up to sell, to be melted down and to be recycled. Effectively, what this is it's the nut off an 18-pounder field gun. So it's the nut that covered over actually the locking points. This protected the locking points that held the wheel on. So a rather large nuts from an 18-pounder field gun. There's an interesting little story connected with this. I don't know anybody that's found one of these because of that very reason. There's big lumps of solid brass and they will be melted down. And the day that I actually found this, I was pleased to say the least. And I took it down to a little local cafe, and the cafe owner, I was showing it to him, and the cafe owner leant behind the counter and pulled one up exactly the same. And I said, "When did you find that?" He said, "Today." And he'd never found one before either. So two of us found one on the same day, and neither of us had ever seen one before. So just one of those odd quirks of fate. So yeah, the cover for a wheel off a field gun for the locking bolt on a field gun.
That is extraordinary, Pete. And I do love those little connections when it's almost like it's preordained, isn't it? That the history wants to be revealed. The battlefields want to give up their secrets, and it's fascinating how often little coincidences like that occur. But you're right, that is a rare find. And it tells another part of the story. We focus a lot on the infantry, but as you said before, artillery was the great killer of the First World War, and finding artifacts that you can link to artillery guns is a pretty rare experience. So that's a well done. That's a great find. Absolutely great find. What else do you have for us in your little bag of tricks?
We did discuss what I was going to show earlier, but I didn't tell you one of them because I just thought it's interesting to bring up. Now, that. So, what is that? I'll put it on something so you can see it a bit clearly. Now, it took me a good year to figure out what this was. I knew it was something interesting, and I thought electrical for a long time. But it's not. It's actually one of the internal workings of a mouth organ. So that is a little mouth organ, part of a mouth organ. Can't do a mouth organ noisy. So that is a really personal bit of kit. That is a soldier who brought a mouth organ onto the battlefields and we like to think just dropped it and lost it. But I think, again, it's unlikely from where it was found. So, but I just found it just a very personal piece of kit, a part of a soldier who's come to the battlefield with his mouth organ, had it in his top pocket as he went into combat. So, yeah, just moving, really.
It's hard not to get emotional about these things, isn't it, Pete? I mean, I found some very personal items on the battlefield, and I know you found a lot of personal items that link very directly to a soldier. And even if you don't know who that soldier is, you can't help but be connected through the centuries with that soldier when you realize you're holding something in your hand and the last person to hold it was the soldier who dropped it, perhaps at the time that he was killed or wounded. It's extraordinary.
It is, and I quite like, to a certain extent, that that fact that we don't know who it is, that anonymity, that we do not know who it belonged to, because you can then use it to represent. And I do. I use all of these things. I can no longer take weaponry rounds to show my students when I'm guiding. So you take little personal things, and they can represent anybody from where you find them. You may have an idea of who it is, but it's only a guess. And I quite like that. I like that you're telling the story of everybody in one object. So I think that's quite important. So we'll move on to the next one, which is, this is a piece of weaponry. So this is an SLME, standard rifle of the Empire Forces and Britain. So it's a relic. There's not a great deal left. All the woodwork's rotted away. It's just the metalwork. We can see the trigger, the magazine. The bolts would have been here for cocking it. So these are not common to be found on the battlefields, but they're not uncommon because they get caught in the spines of the ploughs when they're ploughing. And that's why they nearly always have a bent barrel, as this one does. This one was found just literally up the road from where I live. It was by the side of Delville Wood. And it was literally propped up like that on the bank. And I picked it up and I always take them home to have a look at, but they didn't need to do much. Can you see the magazine? This is the magazine here. That is a lead shrapnel ball embedded in the rifle magazine. So this has a lead shrapnel ball, an airburst blast, and one of the shrapnel balls has embedded itself in the magazine of the rifle. And if anything brings it home, it's something like that, where you still have the weapon or the projectile that did the damage to both the rifle and almost certainly the man that was carrying it. And there's one still embedded in the magazine. So very moving and one of my favourite things to show people. And again, it just brings it home. It brings it home, you know, to see damage caused by uh, by lead shrapnel balls.
That's just extraordinary, Pete. I know that relics like that are unusual to find. That's a very rare find, obviously. What a fantastic connection with that soldier. Just in terms of general relics, things left over from the war, how common is it to find things out in the battlefields?
In the 20 years that I've been here, it's decreased. It has definitely decreased. In the ploughing seasons, you could walk along the sides of the fields. You didn't even need to walk across the fields, which you can. There is a right to roam here in France. You can do that. It's a little bit more fiddly in Belgium. But the right to roam here means that you can actually walk onto the battlefields. And you would find things thrown to the side. The farmer's a rifle wrapped around the spines of the plough. He doesn't want it. He throws it to the sides. Anything else that's big and throws it to the sides. So you could find things at the sides. You very rarely do that nowadays. There's a lot of people that collect, lots of people that walk the battlefields. Little things, and it's those things that I've always enjoyed more. I don't collect anymore at all things, relics from the battlefield, from off the fields any longer, unless it's something just small and interesting and personal that I can just pop into a little box. And I hasten to add, this is all done by just walking, never digging, never metal detecting. This is, you mark one eyeball, just looking in the paddocks as you walk across the fields and paddocks. And to me, that's fair game. I know not everybody agrees with this. Not everybody agrees that things should be picked up. But if you see the new mechanised rotary ploughing and the way things are actually in modern farming, everything gets destroyed. It gets destroyed. It gets broken. It gets broken to smaller pieces that it's gone. And I actually quite like that, as you will have gathered, people who have heard me talking before, like that connection of being able to show somebody something that was actually there, something that belonged to a man and a man carried. So I have no qualms with picking things up off the surface that are on the surface, because if you don't pick them up, then the next time the rotary plough comes across, or one of the various machines they use now for breaking up the soil, it will destroy it, and it will eventually all be gone. So I quite like that, and certainly I feel that because I'm using it to explain to people, as I'm doing now, that it's worthwhile keeping those things. But not everybody will agree with that. Some people think that things should be left in the fields, and they should that's where they should remain. But no, I think mark one eyeball just walking on the surface, picking things up, I don't see a problem with that at all.
I agree with that too. I don't pick things up anymore. I usually just pick something up and take a photo of it, unless it's highly personal or something very important. But also, I've occasionally seen people say that these things should be put in a museum. And I think anyone who's spent some time walking the battlefields would know that the detritus of war that still covers the battlefields would not be accepted by any museum anywhere. It's just really leftover junk to many people. It's only us that care about the history that understand its significance. So it's not some things that would end up in museums. It's not things that these are relics that are deeply personal to the people who discover them.
I think interestingly, I did have a barn. Well, I used to run a bed and breakfast here on the Somme, and I had a barn that was absolutely full of relics for people to go and have a look at. When we closed the bed and breakfast, I heard that the Tietval Centre, which was expanding and creating a little museum, wanted basically a glass floor, and beneath it they wanted the detritus, is that the correct word, of the battlefield beneath this glass floor. And so I donated all of mine. So if ever you go to the Tietval Centre on the Somme and look beneath the glass floor, then all of that detritus from the battlefield came from my barn, and so it ended up in a museum, and it was used as the whole reason for collecting it was so that people could see and experience it and understand a little about what had gone on.
Well, that's really wonderful, Pete. I think that's I certainly agree with you that it's great that these things are being seen. Do you have anything else from your little goodie box to show us? Or?
Yeah, final thing is something that's rare and unusual, really, and took a bit of fiddling out or thinking and looking at books to figure out what it was. This is the emergency tripod that went underneath the barrel of a Vickers machine gun. A Vickers machine gun is on a mount, so it sits on the mount. But in an emergency, if you've lost the mount, This was fastened to the front. This bit goes around the barrel, the fluted barrel. These are the remains of the feet. The feet were a lot longer, about to there. Were metal, they rotted off. But this is just an interesting and very rare bit of kit that went underneath the barrel of a Vickers machine gun. So again, it's something that... A part of my enjoyment is actually doing that, is identifying what these things are, trying to figure out what these things are. And it took a little while with this one, but that's what it is. It's an emergency mount from a... Got lumps falling off it. Emergency mount from a Vickers machine gun.
Well, as you said, Pete, these are, you know, to anyone else, to people who don't care about the history, these are just lumps of weird twisted metal. But it's the passion that we have for the history that makes them significant. So I think it's really wonderful that you've got them to show to people as you lead them around the battlefields, and indeed on episodes like this. Pete, it's been a really wonderful exploration of a few very little important pieces of history, and a reminder of why it's important to get out and walk the ground and the connection you can make with the landscape. So, mate, I can't wait to get back over there again. I'm due over there very soon to be on the battlefields. I'll look forward to enjoying a cold beer with you, mate, and getting out and doing just what we've talked about, walking the ground and getting in touch with that landscape. So, Pete, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Western Front certainly is an extraordinary battlefield, and I love getting over there and walking the ground in Belgium and in the Somme in France. It's just such a very special place. But I think what we would say is that the Anzac legend matured and grew up on the Western Front, but it was born at Gallipoli. We all know the story of Gallipoli. The reason we're here commemorating Anzac Day is because of that landing on the shores of Gallipoli on the 25th of April 1915. And Gallipoli really is a unique battlefield in the world. There's nowhere else you can go where you can still see the terrain that the Anzacs had to face during that campaign. And it wasn't just the Turks that proved a formidable enemy, it was the ground as well, and the ridges, the valleys, the steep country the Anzacs had to face. It was an impossible task they'd been set, and yet they stuck to it very bravely for 9 very long months. And it's wonderful to go and walk the ground at Gallipoli. You can connect to history in a way that you can't on any other battlefield. It's a place that I love going there and walking the ground, and I've had the privilege on a number of occasions to go there with this man that we're going to introduce now, our next guest. It's historian Peter Hart. Pete, it's always a great pleasure to catch up with you. And I should say that it wasn't that long ago, a few years ago, we had the great pleasure of catching up together actually in Gallipoli, which was a pretty amazing experience. And I think when you tell people you've been to Gallipoli with Peter Hart, they look at you with a mix of admiration and compassion. But mate, it was a great trip. We scaled ridges, we walked valleys and washaways, and it was a really great trip. But it sums up what we're talking about today, mate, which is the importance of getting out and walking the ground. I mean, let's just put it plainly. Why is it not enough to sit there and read a history book or watch a documentary? Why should you get out and walk the ground?
You never get the same experience. I'd read all about Gallipoli before I went, but when you actually go and when you stand there at V Beach or W Beach and you realise this is where it happened and you can look around, see what they saw at the time. Yeah, all right, things have changed a bit, but the terrain doesn't change. Really, it's just the same. You can, for instance, at V Beach, you could see that low bank behind which people were crouching in that famous photograph. At W Beach, you can see the piers. They're still there. They're still visible. You can see some of the barges on the beach. It's an amazing feeling. And if you've really got into a subject, and I was so keen on Gallipoli, I was a weird child. I spent my childhood reading about things like Gallipoli. To actually be there is not just exciting, but somehow you learn so much more. You gain so much more. I think commercial people call it added value. And you get enormous amounts of added value by being there. And it's not being part of it. You'll never be part of it. But you are where it happened. It's fantastic, Matt.
Mate, a question I've never actually asked you before is you've written a lot of books about Gallipoli, but had you been to the peninsula when you wrote your first book?
No, I hadn't. That was Defeat at Gallipoli with Nigel Steele. And no, I hadn't. And that's one reason that I'm so keen on it now. And I tell people you have to go, because I went the first time in a joint visit with the Australian War Memorial and the Imperial War Museum, and they took us along as so-called experts. What was interesting was I knew the maps, so I did actually, and I played it on one of your tours, the Poziers one, where I just learn everything with my somewhat strange memory. I forget it about a day later, and then go, well, that'll be the 11th Battalion or the 21st Battalion, and I learnt all the ridges to annoy the Aussies. And I knew them, but that's theoretical knowledge. And it was when I got there that I mean, I called it Defeat at Gallipoli. I never thought Gallipoli would succeed or could have. But when I got there, you realise it's just in front of you, especially at Anzac. You just stand there and go, oh, this is impossible. It doesn't matter. People say the British made mistakes or the Australians made mistakes. Yeah, they did. But also, when you get there, you realise how good the Turks were, what a fantastic defence they put up. And I know to you as well, that's a very important part of the story. And when you get there and you stand where the Turks were and you see where the Australians, for instance, had to advance, the New Zealanders, you just think, what a hiding to nothing they were onto. I mean, I nearly swore there. I know you would be shocked at me swearing, but bad language just spring to mind when you look at what they had to do at Anzac. I'm not kidding.
It's hard to avoid that that feeling, mate, when you stand there. I know exactly what you mean. How did it compare? You'd looked at maps and you'd written books about it and studied it in depth and spoken to a lot of veterans. How did it compare when you were actually standing there at Helles or Anzac or Suvla to all the information you'd gathered over the decades?
It was decades by then because it was 2001, I think I went, and I'd been doing it since about the late 60s. Things were much more dramatic. And for instance, the razor between Pluggies and Russell's Top is much more jagged. It's much more dramatic than I thought. The terrain is worse than I thought in every way. I'd sort of got an intellectual appreciation of how bad it was. It's not just there. Achi Baba, you see how it dominates Helles. Yes, it's not that big a hill. It's not, but it does dominate it. And then again, you see the Gully Ravine. You see how dramatic it is, how it splits the line. But one other thing that I shared with you, Matt, is that, and this didn't happen on my first trip because the Australian War Memorial didn't want to go there. I wanted to see Kilid Bahir. Now, Kilid Bahir, no one goes to Kilid Bahir because we never got there. In fact, we had a great day during the 25th of April when we went everywhere that we never got to. But we went to Kilid Bahir. That was the real first day objective or second day objective. Achibabu was the first day objective. And when you get there, and that's actually seeing that, you understand why Kilid Bahir is the real objective, because it totally dominates the straits. You remember standing there and in between swearing at me for having dragged you up there. You were quite verbal, as well as the other one, with the cone-shaped hill. I've forgotten. Is that Maltepe?
Maltepe, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of swearing done that day. But if you don't see these things, you don't appreciate the ground. And Maltepe and Kilid Bahir are important. You've got to get up there and see them. That's when you understand. Now, that's not an ordinary trip, but at least you can see those features dominating the landscape. As you drive about at Helles, and you can see from Anzac and Helles, you can see Kilid Bahir. We have a mutual friend, Blent, who calls it the big bastard, because there it is. Whatever you think of the objectives, like Chunuk Bahir, you look at Kilid Bahir, it's a monster. It just is like a wall across the way they have to go. And that's what they have to take to dominate the straits, which is, of course, why they were there.
It was a pretty special day, Pete, and we had the luxury of having a few extra days up our sleeve. And what we always say about Gallipoli is that the landscape and the terrain, that was as much of an enemy as the Turkish soldiers. Not to take anything away from the Turks, they did a brilliant job. But they that did. Terrain is extraordinary. And I loved that day, mate, because we called it the what-if day. We went to all the sites that... These weren't battlefield sites because there'd been no fighting there because no one ever got close to them. The Allies didn't get anywhere near these sites, but they were objectives. These were objectives that the Allies were supposed to take. And by going there, it enabled us to understand more about the history and what Gallipoli would have evolved into had the Allies taken their early objectives. So, you know, Maltepe, which was an early Anzac objective, and obviously Kilid Bahir, the big plateau at Helles that the British and French were supposed to capture. I mean, it was a pretty extraordinary day.
It was fabulous, but should an ordinary tour go there? No, because it don't have to, but they should have them drawn to their attention. You can see them as dominant figures on the landscape. That's how you understand the landscape. You need to see it and understand why it's important, and that's all you need to do. If you have an extra 2 or 3 days, yeah, fine, go up them and swear at each other. Why are we doing this? It's steep. Couldn't we drive up here? That was Maltepe. You could drive up there. We later discovered most of the way anyway.
Oh, but we walked it because we're hardy, so we walked it.
I'm not sure how hardy we are, but it was a great day. And but that's what the landscape. And when you get to Suvla Bay as well, and I always call it a big country, and you understand that operations there are very, very different. They're big. The distance between places isn't a couple of hundred yards like it is at Anzac or even at Helles. It's a couple of miles. It's still minute compared to the Western Front, though. Fantastic places. And so beautiful. Even your blackened soul, Matt, as a captain of industry, would warm to some of the views. And you can see Samothrace and you can see Imbros and the islands. It's just wonderful. What a place.
I'll skip over that bit and just say that I do absolutely enjoy going to Gallipoli. I love it. It's one of my favourite places. And we mentioned these places that we don't go to on a regular tour, but one place that you love taking people to on a tour that I know is Gully Ravine. And this is a big scar in the landscape that cuts up the sort of the western side of the peninsula in the Helles sector. Just tell us a little bit about that, about why you like to take people there and what Gully Ravine tells you about the Helles story.
It's such an amazing place from the beach, which is exactly as it was, and even has an old lighter that was wrecked on the last day of the campaign. It was wrecked 9th of January 1916. It was wrecked there. It's still there, the remnants of it. But when you go into the gully and you go past where the horse lines were, well, all those pictures I've seen so many times, there's where the horses were. There's the bones from when we shot the horses in the gully. And you go up and it gets deeper and deeper, and you suddenly realize, oh, it's like a gigantic communication trench. And then the cliffs start on either side, and it's just an amazing place. Now, if you're that way inclined, people say it's haunted by the ghosts of all who died. That's nonsense. But what it is you just realize what a terrible place it was to fight in. And when you get to those two barricade trenches, the Turkish barricade trench, it's actually a geological feature, but they're about 80 yards apart. I remember showing you them in the British front line and the Turkish line just ahead. And they had to attack from there. And there was no trees or bushes then, as there are and perhaps in films now. They're just amazing. And we have accounts of people who were there, and to be there and to just stand at that barricade and think about charging forward in a bare sort of empty valley. And, I don't know how people did it. The different generation, different world. I mean, I'm not saying that our soldiers are not as good as soldiers are soldiers. But what a thing it was. And Gully Ravine is an amazing environment. There's just so much to see in there. You really get a feel, and you can't see Achi Baba. Everywhere else you can see Achi Baba. You can't see it from the gully, and they couldn't see you. Hence when I referred to it as a gigantic communication trench, everything funneled up there. I remember, I mean, we sing a song, tramping up the gully, tramping up the gully. It goes on for about 2 minutes. We're tramping up the gully. That's funny, but a lot of them came back in ambulances, and there's some amazing pictures of the ambulances going over the rough terrain at the bottom, because it's a stream and rocks and everything, and in the mud and everything. And imagine that, Matt, with a broken pelvis or a broken leg or any, shot through the chest. You're not going to survive that. But it's a place to think. It's a place to enjoy, if you like. It's a place, but place to think, definitely, and to appreciate what people went through.
It's I'm actually working on a book about the Battle of Krithia, which took place down in that area. Well, several battles, and all of them with the same outcome, as you well know, Pete. But it just reminds me as well, the soldiers not only had to fight in these terrible conditions, but also with just such a lack of information. Gully Ravine was described during the first Battle of Krithia, so in the days after the landing, as a small stream on the left of the British line. How do you think the first British troops felt when they got there and found a 100-foot ravine leading down to the small stream? There is a small stream, but it's at the bottom of a ravine. It's not just running through the countryside. Just
until
extraordinary.
Until a storm when it was a raging torrent. To get everything at Gallipoli. On the podcast, Gary Bain would say that soldiers wouldn't complain, but they'd observe a lot when they found that ravine in their path, and they'd observe quite a lot. It is on the maps, and it is fairly clear on the maps. But there's a great, I think his name was Bertram, Captain Bertram, a Royal Naval Officer, who said, "Yes, these features are plainly visible, but I've always found that army officers can't read maps." It's probably right.
Well, mate, at the other end of the peninsula, we went from, on one day we did Gully Ravine, but then another day we were way up in the northern sector of Anzac, and we did the infamous Cheshire Ridge, which was a great day. I mean, that was probably the first day, and you blooded me early on in our trip, because we took an opportunity to explore. exactly. But we took an opportunity to explore that absolute mad tangle of country that the August offensives took place in, the big wheeling maneuver that the Anzacs and the British took when they tried to break out of the Anzac sector. And that was some tough country. I know that you wouldn't normally go there and take passengers on a tour there. What an extraordinary totally spot not. That is, though.
it's not safe. It's not dangerous, but it's not safe for a touring party. It is an extraordinary part. It's a razor ridge, like the razor. I mean, in parts, you're just walking along something, and there's a fair chance if you trip twice, you'd hurt yourself. It's one of those ones where I always say you need to trip twice to really do yourself damage. But then London traffic's like that. I'm sure Sydney traffic's like that as well. But it is, and what I always wanted to go to small tabletop. I'd stood on large tabletop, which is halfway down Rodendron Ridge, where the New Zealanders met before going up there on the attack on the August 6th, I think. Head's going funny. And I'd always wanted to get to it. It looked so dramatic. And then first time I went there, I went with two real tough, roughy soldiers. Just because I thought it might be an idea to make sure I was all right, because Belent wasn't available that day. But what a trip it was. I can't remember whether Belent was with us that day. I don't think he was he? No, I can't remember.
No, not the day we went, no.
No, well, we were. I wouldn't recommend it on your own, that's for certain. With two, you're all right. I mean, you've just got to, it's just amazing. And the perception, Gary. Hello, Gary. the perception, Matt, is amazing. You stand on, little tabletop and look across that tangled web of ground that basically the August offensive was going to get. And again, you realise you don't need a map in one sense. You can just look at it and think, this is impossible. This is impossible. It would be impossible if the Turks weren't armed. They'd still probably stop you. It's just the ground is amazing. And there's so many wonderful pictures of that area of ground that we've all seen. But to actually be there, to just see it. And you might say, well, how can we go and see that? You've just said it's dangerous. Well, again, it's for an extra day and with an experienced guide. But what about the walk down Rhododendron Ridge, which a lot of your tours do, or our tours do? And you get most of the view from there and not so much of the danger.
I think for me, Pete, Cheshire Ridge was really special because it sums up that perspective. We can read as much as we like about the August offensive and how it was going to be impossible. We can, even if you see it, you can see it from the high ground at Walker's Ridge, and from the neck, you can look down on that country and you go, wow, that's some pretty tough country. When you're in it, when, you know, the crazy Peter Hart is leading you up ridge and down dale and through thorn bushes, and it's you just think, how do you fight in this? Plus, they were doing it in the dark. Plus, they were all racked with dysentery. They didn't know where the Turks were, and buggers were shooting at them. You know how? If I said to you, Pete, start at the beach and walk up to the top of that hill, and I'll see you at the top, you would arrive, if you arrived at all, dishevelled, dying of thirst, cut to bits by thorns. It would be a tough trek today without people shooting at you. Well, how in the hell were they supposed to do it in the dark with the Turks holding them up with dysentery? Like, how would you do it? And that's the point. You don't understand until you go and walk the ground and experience it for yourself.
I can't remember whether I took you to Taylor's Gap, which is where Monash's troop, 4th Australian Brigade, went through. When you see it, it's amazing. But also you realise that two or three Turks on either side could just embugger you completely. What do? You go after them? Do you stop? Do you carry on? Do you press on? You don't know where you are. When you come out, you come out. I have been lost in daylight as an experienced Gallipoli guide wandering in the hills between, for instance, Hill 60, Hill 100, and then up the spur to the top. It's just amazing country. Which ridge are you on? Which valley are you in? And it's the point I always make going back to Anzac. If you're on top of a ridge, you're dead because the Turks will shoot you. If you're not on top of the ridge, you can't see where you are. Which ridge are you on? Are you on first ridge, second ridge, third ridge? Then there's all the other ridges that weren't named. They are named now. That's what I learned to annoy the Aussies, but I've forgotten most of them. But wow, it's very exciting. You're making me. I'm going back there in May, so I can't wait. You're freshening my appetite.
I'm getting excited by it as well. And I think the other thing that it revealed too was, I mean, we found relics from the fighting. We found, sadly, a number of human remains. I mean, yeah. This is country that, you know, tiger country, as Vietnam veterans would call it. It's places that people don't normally go to. And you don't have to get far off the beaten track to just get this incredible perspective of what the Gallipoli battlefields were like. It's just, I say that to people always when they go to Gallipoli, it's great to go there in a car and a coach and look around, but just even take 20 minutes, get off the beaten track, go into the scrub, have a look around, see what you can find. There's just so much to discover that's still left over from the campaign. It's really quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, we found, I mean, obviously you have to treat them with, human remains are, it's not like the Western Front where they stop everything and investigate. Gallipoli, they're reburied, you put them on, it's quite chastening sometimes. I think you've been on Hill 60 with me, at the back of Hill 60 where the Turks were. There's bones still in the field. You see knuckles, bits of skull. It makes you think. But then that's, battlefield tourism is a funny thing because it's a mixture, isn't it? It's a mixture of wanting to experience what they did, but not the reality, obviously. It's about paying your respect. It's about the drama of the story. It's about wanting to understand. And for me, I know the other things are all important, but for me, it's wanting to understand. And that's the thing about the ground. When you look at Hill 60, for instance, you can see why the Turks had to get, it's a two-humped hill. There's one hump, there's the other. We had to get that one so we could see all the back of the Turkish lines behind W Hills and the rest of it. They had to get that so they could see the link between Anzac and Suvla. Neither have got, they both held their bit. They couldn't get the other bit. And it's when you're on Hill 60, you understand that. I never really understood the importance of Hill 60. It's not a towering hill. Guess how tall it is?
61 feet.
Yeah, I never know whether it's feet or meters, so I shouldn't have asked that. I think it's feet.
I think it's feet. It's the weird thing is it's feet in Gallipoli and it's meters on the Western Front. So Hill 60 on the Western Front in Belgium is 60 meters, but Hill 60 on Gallipoli is 60 feet high, which is not even, that doesn't even count as a hill. That's a slight incline.
You barely notice some of them, yeah. But there you go. Something that would never happen to Pete Smith is the first time I ever visited Ypres, I went straight over Pilcombe Ridge without noticing it. There you go. Pilcombe Ridge is very important, as Pete would tell you. Lots of Pete's.
Well, Pete, you mentioned the importance of understanding and how you explore and discover. And there's a program that's currently going on that we were great beneficiaries of, which I think is fantastic, where the Turkish authorities are uncovering sectors of the battlefield that are buried beneath the scrub. And we've talked about this quite a bit in podcasts. We made a video about it on YouTube about exploring trenches at Gallipoli. But I think it's absolutely fantastic, mate. They're cutting the scrub. So there's areas of just about everywhere at Gallipoli is choked in scrub. But what I didn't realize was if you cut that scrub away, there's incredible preserved trench systems beneath it. So they're cutting the scrub just at ground level, but leaving all the roots in place to hold the soil in place. And then for a year or two, it's exposed, and then Mother Nature is reclaiming it. And we explored the trenches at Silt Spur near Lone Pine in the Anzac.
Amazing.
Mate, what a day that was. I mean, I've asked you about it before, but just give us your impressions of walking through that complete Anzac trench system.
Well, you'd found that map from the 11th Battalion. Was it 11th Battalion? Anyway.
I think it's the 10th.
Yeah. Our memories, you know. And you'd find we tracked the support line reaching back to the next ridge, the communication trench, that was a tunnel then, it was collapsed now. But then we found the other tunnels that were still there that went through to the front line. We found the front line, all the fighting bays are there. They're clearly exactly, remember you had the map saying you should find, and then we went and the best, the periscope posts. You remember the two periscope posts where some poor sod about 60, 80 yards from the next Turkish ridge had to go with a periscope and there was a sort of tunnel out to it. And then they just stand there. I'd have wet myself, I think. That was special. And then right at the end, there was the machine gun post and the sniping post right at the end, five finger or whatever it's called. That was special, but it's not the only one. They've also now done Pope's, and it's just amazing. All the back, you know, Dead Man's Hill, where me and you got scratched a bit, where we found that barbed wire, that's cleared now. Where I've got that wonderful account from people, a bloke I interviewed who was there, and he described being wounded there and all the people being killed on Dead Man's Ridge. Wonder how he got that name, Matt. And then tumbling himself back down the hit into Bloody Angle. What a place. And that's all now you can. And for a year or two, you'll be able to walk around and look at it. And some of behind the Turkish lines as well are just absolutely brilliant. They've got their graveyard up on Battleship Hill. It's been uncovered. And it's just, the whole program's great. Some people worry that it will destroy the battlefield. To them, I say, what's the point of having it if you can't see it? And the roots are still there. I think it's worthwhile. And anyway, we're alive now. I want to see it.
It's a great. I mean, it was one of the greatest things I've ever done on a battlefield, was walking with a trench map in hand, a complete trench system, because the difference there is, unlike, you know, preserved trench systems on the Western Front or elsewhere, and even at Gallipoli, you know, it's, if you go to the Neck or Johnson's Jolly, they've been manicured a bit, they've changed over time. They're trenches, and so you can stand them in a kind of abstract way and go, okay, I'm in a trench at Gallipoli. But Silt Spur, because it had just been uncovered literally weeks before, we could walk at trench map in hand and see every bay. I remember coming around the corner and saying, well, if I'm reading this correctly, there'll be an officer's headquarter dugout somewhere here. And as I walked around the corner, you were standing in it. You were standing in the dugout, still cut into the wall of the remaining trench. Where have you ever seen anything like that? I mean, I'm getting super excited now back there, mate. It's extraordinary.
Well, I mean, it was an amazing opportunity. And I think the idea of doing a bit at a time is a good idea. Just reveal it, then let it grow back. And then that's the best way to do it. And not to do it all at once, because that would be damaging, I think. It's an enormous amount of work for people as well. That's one thing we should pay tribute to, the Turkish workforce who cleared these areas. I mean, I wouldn't fancy doing it. It's a big, what is it, 200 or 300 yards by a couple of hundred yards, that area they've cleared. And it's heavy going. They've done well. Hard workers.
Yeah, they're doing wonderful work. The Turkish authorities over there and the Turkish people are doing a wonderful job of maintaining this, such an important link with history. And Pete, we can't say enough about Gallipoli and about the importance of the landscape, the importance of the terrain. We've got to get back over there, mate, and walk it again. And I'm looking forward to a cold Efes Pilsner at the end of a long, sweaty day. But mate, it's always great to catch up with you and just hear your enthusiasm for walking the ground at Gallipoli. And I'd encourage everyone to do it at some stage in their life. It's a unique place.
It is. Okay, then.
Pete, thank you very much for your time. It's always a pleasure, mate.
Cheers. Bye, Matt.
Well, thank you so much to the two Peters who joined us to talk all about the battlefields of France and Belgium and of Gallipoli. They're just such special places. And I hope that you've come away with some understanding of why it's so important to get out there and walk the ground and what a special experience it is. At the end of the day, it's the landscape that defined these battles, that defined these campaigns, and it's the landscape that we can still visit today and that we can still connect with as we learn about this history and walk the ground in the footsteps of the Anzacs. So if you haven't had a chance to do it, to walk the ground on the Western Front or Gallipoli, I hope that you will very soon in the future, because the battlefields are still there. They're still giving up their secrets and they still have a lot to tell us even a century later. So thank you for joining us for this Anzac Day. I hope it's been a special time for you. And like always, on this special day, lest we forget.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast. anyone invite you to listen to our show?
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like to support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Firstly, you can become a member. For a small monthly fee, you could subscribe to the show and listen to every episode ad-free and also receive exclusive episodes directly from Pete and I. So see the link in the show notes to sign up at Acast Plus and become a member of the show. Also, if you want to make a one-off contribution, you can now buy us a coffee. Visit buymeacoffee.com/battlewalks and you can make a small contribution there. See you next week.